And this one is going to be from Dr. L.J. Tan. Dr. Tan currently serves as a member, liaison member of the ACIP, of the Advisory Council of Elimination of Tuberculosis, the Scientific Advisory Board of the Coalition of Safe Needle Disposal, and the Steering Committee of Voices for Vaccines, the 317 Coalition, and various other immunization type of organizations. He recently organized the first National Immunization Congress and served on numerous expert infectious disease and immunization panels and speaks at numerous national meetings and media conferences. He received his BS at Duke University, his MS at NYU in molecular biology, and his PhD at Northwestern University Medical School in microbiology and immunology. So we're delighted to have Dr. Tan.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. And thanks to all of you for being here. The nice thing about being the final speaker is that I really don't have to say much. And on that note, I think I will just sit down. But the good thing also about being the final speaker is that I can kind of try to get my talk over with quickly so that you all can have an opportunity for questions and answers, because I think that's probably most important for you all. So being the summary speaker, I think I can realize that I'll probably be repeating a lot of things you've already heard, and we'll go from there. And I just want to put the title slide up there just to show you that I declare I have no financial, no conflict of interests. This you already have seen. I think this is your little background slide on herpes zoster, and I'm going to go skip that because you've already seen a lot of that. And the question we're all here to try to figure out is, why is herpes zoster vaccine so underutilized? I mean, as you heard earlier from Dr. Hurley, vaccine coverage about 1.9% in the 60 and older, again with that same caveat that this was before the official publication in the MMWR of the recommendations. And as we know, a lot of private payers use the actual physical publication in the MMWR as the trigger point for actually paying for the vaccine. There's an economic burden for the patient, and so you have to ask yourself, is there sufficient patient demand for the vaccine? There's an economic burden for the physician. It's a difficult vaccine to store, as you've already heard. And what we're hearing is that a lot of patients are being put on the waiting list until there's a sufficient number to justify the practice ordering the vaccine, remembering that the vaccine comes in 10 dose portions or packages. There are, of course, the complex payment processes for the physician, and I'll try to summarize a little bit of that to give you a little bit more understanding on that. And I think all of this actually generally reflects a problem that we have with adult immunizations and the apathy with adult immunization that we have in general in the United States. So the economic burden for the patient, well, it's the most expensive vaccine for the 60 and older. The average wholesale price is about $194. Retail prices, as you've already heard from Dr. Harpaz, is over $200 and maybe as high as $300. So while those over 60 may be aware of the vaccine, I will tell you most are not aware of its cost. And a significant number may defer immunizations in the patient when they discover the cost. And for the physician, this is actually a very difficult barrier to ascertain, because many actually have no idea what the cost is to the patient may be. And obviously this will vary between whether the payer is a private payer or whether it's Medicare or any of the other mechanisms that Dr. Harpaz has already mentioned. And for a lot of physicians, a huge concern is that they're afraid that this will actually result in inequitable access to herpes zoster vaccine. In other words, if you can pay for the vaccine, you get it, but if you can't, it's hard for you to get it. The economic burden for the physician, as many of you have already heard, many physicians that serve the 60 and over are not necessarily accustomed to immunizing. Many of them are acute care internists who see older patients, and if they're not immunizing in their practice, it may be hard for them to start immunizing in their practice. And I think you saw one of the barriers for the general intern from Dr. Hurley's slide was this idea of the freezer, the freezing nature, the need to keep the vaccine frozen. And so as a result, the inventory management for the physician actually is very complex with regards to herpes zoster. Stocking an expensive frozen vaccine presents obviously very unique challenges. And as I said earlier, vaccine comes in these 10-dose packages, and once you open the package, you've got to figure out how do you want to use the rest of the vaccine, and do you want to keep it on your shelf as your vaccines come in. And that may obviously be a reason for why, while 51% reported stocking the vaccine, the number of patients they deliver the vaccine to is extremely small. The other question that physicians have to ask themselves is, you know, do distributors carry the vaccine consistently? And finally, as I said earlier, many physicians may end up creating a waiting list before they order the vaccine. When they have 10 patients ready to go, they'll get the vaccine, call them all in, and vaccinate them. The complex payment processes, well, is it Medicare Part D or is it Medicare Part B? Well, as all of you now probably know, the answer is it's Medicare Part D, D as in dog. So Medicare Part D, it's administered by individual drug plans that contract with the pharmacies. So the Medicare Part D carrier, of which there are many thousands in the United States, will contract with pharmacies, and they're called in-network providers. And the pharmacy will then build a plan and charge the patient the appropriate copay. And the copay will vary across plans, but basically it's generally about 25% of the cost of the pharmaceutical, and in this case, obviously, the cost of the vaccine. So what you want to keep in mind then is that it is not designed to pay for vaccines that are provided in physicians' offices, and there will be variability across the plans. A physician is therefore considered what we call an out-of-network provider. What happens in these cases, in most cases, is the patient will pay the full amount to the provider, and then the patient is then required to submit a claim form. Some plans, not a lot, will have other special procedures that may actually try to move beyond that. But in most cases, the patient submits the claim form. The vaccine administration fee is covered by Medicare Part D, but there's significant variability between the carriers, and there's no hard standard that has been, excuse me. You know what, this is what's bad, is that you think that, you think I would have turned this off, wouldn't you? You can also tell who gets my ringtones from me. I apologize for that, but it was a little levity in the evening, I guess. So the vaccine administration fee, you know, and what CMS basically tells the Part D carriers is that they expect that Part D plans will take the Part B administration fee structure into consideration when they decide what the administrative fee to the provider should be. And obviously that results in a lot of variability across the Part D plans. And then for the patient, and this is that big unknown, no one really knows whether the vaccine ultimately will get covered because there is that donut hole. And that donut hole, as I've circled with my own donut hole in red, is this difference when you hit 2,200 of initial coverage limit with total drug expenses. So between $2,200 and $3,600, nothing is covered. It's out of pocket for the Medicare Part D patient. And if it so happens that you've purchased all your, if you're an elderly patient and you've purchased your pharmaceuticals and you're at that donut hole, your vaccine will not be covered. And you may not necessarily know this as a patient, and I can tell your physician may not necessarily know this as your physician. And so that's obviously a huge challenge. So how do you address this challenge? Well, obviously there's a significant administrative burden that's being placed on the patient and the physician, and some of the recommendations from Dr. Hurley's presentation are very, very valid. So what are the ways you can do this? There's obviously the in-network solution, and these two that you see in these second and third bullet points are the in-network possible solutions. The physician can call in a prescription to a specialty pharmacy. A specialty pharmacy is in-network, who then ships the vaccine to the physician. When the physician gets the vaccine, he or she then administers the vaccine, and the specialty pharmacy bills the plan and the patient for the vaccine cost and the copay. If you're confused, you should be. what does that result in, obviously, is missed opportunities, because your patient has to come back to get vaccinated. The patient has to identify a carrier, and the physician then needs to follow through. A lot of opportunities for missed opportunities. So if we can simplify this process, I think that's an opportunity there that we can try to exploit for in-network administration of herpes zoster. The other way is for the physician to write a prescription, and you've heard this already from Dr. Hurley, and send the patient to a retail pharmacy for vaccination. Again, retail pharmacies are generally in-network because of the pharmaceutical benefit plans. Of course, while we don't encourage brown bagging, you know it occurs, and as you saw the data, 33% end up brown bagging the vaccine back. Documentation, if the vaccine is administered at the pharmacy, will be challenging for the physician. And then the pharmacy may not carry vaccine. And this is anecdotal, but I can tell you the number of calls we get at the AMA from patients who say their physician gave them a prescription, they go to the pharmacy, and the pharmacy does not administer the vaccine. And hopefully that's changing as we evolve herpes zoster vaccination down the road. But of course, if that happens, that results in missed opportunities. And of course, for the physician, it provides the physician a very difficult explanation for the patient, where they wrote a prescription and it can't be filled. And of course, there's some patients who may not be comfortable with being vaccinated in a pharmacy. So what about out-of-network solutions? And if we can find methods to facilitate out-of-network solutions, that may also help increase the coverage of herpes zoster. So the Part D plan, for example, can provide patients with very specific information regarding their coverage that they can bring to the physicians, and as part of that documentation, the physician may be able to directly bill the plan. So the, in other words, shift the burden to the plan, to the Part D carrier, to make vaccination feasible. And if we're all about trying to increase coverage rates, this should be a no-brainer. The other thing is obviously to facilitate a web-based electronic billing, and a lot of medical specialty societies, including the family physicians and the College of ACP and the AMA, supports this process. And this is basically a system where the cost of the vaccine can be paid without imposing any new administrative burdens, and it allows the patient to receive the vaccine immediately and thereby reducing missed opportunities. And as you've already heard, there is a web-based electronic billing system that's already out there called eDispense, and I have the enrollment information up there as well. There is a couple of caveats here. The physician has to enroll, and then the patient's plan also needs to be enrolled. But once that has happened, the patient then comes in, the physician looks it up in the eDispense, and the match is made, physician gives the vaccine, bills directly to the plan. And so that is obviously our best case scenario. If we can get this system working, I think it will relieve a lot of these billing complications. And finally, what has already been suggested is this idea of perhaps moving all of adult vaccines into Medicare Part B as in boy. And as we know, that would bring it into with influenza, hepatitis B, and pneumococcal vaccines. What about private insurance? I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, because if private insurance covers the vaccine, that generally tends to be less of an issue with reimbursement. And I think you kind of saw trends towards that in Dr. Hurley's presentation. So the summary, I think what you've heard today very clearly is that the challenge with herpes zoster vaccine is not necessarily about education of the value of the vaccine. I think you saw from Dr. Hurley's presentation that there's a strong awareness in the physician population about the efficacy and the value of this vaccine in terms of herpes zoster as well as PHN. I think what we need to figure out is how to simplify both in-network and out-of-network options for paying for the vaccine and its administration. We need to address this issue of the donut hole if the vaccine stays in Part D as in dog. And we need to obviously to continue to encourage private payer coverage. And I think with the official publication in MNWR, we are seeing this. And I think the final thing that we need to help our providers recognize is that there is help out there. There is Merck does have a vaccine reimbursement support center. And then when you call this hotline, they give you advice on how you can negotiate this very complicated billing minefield. So thank you very much for your attention. I'm going to stop here and turn this back to Dr. Harpaz so he can moderate your questions.
Thank you very much. This is now open for questions. Yes, hi. Dr. Kemp, hi.
Is this on?
Is this on? Okay. LJ, I'm Allie Kemp from University of Colorado. I wonder if you could discuss for a few moments why not move this vaccine into Medicare Part B. What is the resistance to this, and what is it going to take, since this obviously is a system that is not working through Part D?
Thank you, Allison. That's a good question. I think that requires an understanding of how what Part B is about and how vaccines ended up in Part B as in boy in the first place. I think the three vaccines that are in Medicare Part B, influenza, pneumococcal, and hepatitis B vaccines, are there by legislation. So it's a congressional act, legislative act that puts them in Part B as in boy. As part of the Medicare reform that occurred in the late 1990s, what happened was vaccines were considered to be a pharmaceutical benefit and placed in Part D as in dog. Remembering at that time, the three impacted vaccines were in B by legislation. So there was never any, I don't think there was a considerable forethought as to what the implication of that would have been. And I think now that, unfortunately, we're in at that point where it's part of the reformed the Medicare Modernization Act, the challenge now is that it's there in Part D. The other three are there by legislation, and how do we get those vaccines back? So it was part of the Medicare Modernization Act, and I think it was probably in that complicated process, the implication of what happened was probably not thought through. And I think that was the challenge. How do you get it back into Part B? Obviously, legislation is one way to do it. And maybe there might be some administrative paths as well. But I think they're being explored.
Hello, I'm Linda Ori, and I teach at Creighton University School of Pharmacy. Hi, LJ.
And I just want to comment on pharmacists as a provider of Zostavax. I will say that as pharmacists, we were kind of flabbergasted by this, as with a lot of Part D Medicare. But I think pharmacists are a very logical option for administration of Zostavax. We are the most available healthcare professional. There's one in almost every block, sometimes it seems, for patients' availability. We are very used to storage of vaccines. Our storage of drugs in general generally have the freezer capacity, have the systems for ordering these products, and we are used to, although not always happy with, billing for Medicare Part D, which is a pretty horrendous process, believe me. But we are used to having to do the order, the check. We can go ahead and cover that fee without having a direct bill to patients for the part that they're covered. We're also used to checking for the donut hole. I teach for American Pharmacists Association, and we strongly, strongly teach our pharmacists, as we're teaching them, not to brown bag this vaccine. We believe there's a lot of risks associated with that. We're very happy to work in a system that allows physicians to administer it. It's kind of silly not to, but I think we all should be thinking about pharmacists as a very logical, very accessible provider for this vaccine.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Linda. And you know me pretty well, so I was presenting a very strong physician perspective today, and I did not mean, obviously, to neglect the opportunity to provide this vaccine in the pharmacies. And I personally believe that with adult immunization in general, I think we need to use all available means to get the vaccine into the arms. And I think the pharmacists are obviously a phenomenal way to do that as well. So thank you.
I'm Lance Chilton, also from the University of New Mexico. I would like to comment on being part of another donut hole. I am in that donut hole between the age at first administration of this vaccine and my Medicare eligibility. Therefore, my private insurance covered herpes zoster vaccine. I think it would behoove the AMA and others to emphasize that that is a simpler way of going with respect to those people who do have coverage under their private insurance policies prior to the onset of Medicare.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
One quick question. Hey, good morning. Dr. Amy Kahn with Concentra. We take care of a large number of America's workforce, and I didn't hear anything related to the cost-benefit analysis of this vaccine. And in particular, given the prevalence of post-herpetic neuralgia, the symptoms of pain, that has a huge impact on productivity. I'm also curious about the age recommendation, age 60. More and more of our workers are working longer, and I guess 70 is the new 60, or 75 is the new 65, but regardless, I'm wondering about earlier immunization and to the point that the gentleman made prior to me, using group health coverage to deliver the vaccine.
Thank you. I think that's a great point. I think the issue about the concept of presenteeism, where you might be working but not able to work fully effectively if you have post-herpetic neuralgia, or you're actually out of work. I don't know of any data that relate to that in the context of Zoster, so those are important points. And we have time for that one last question.
Okay. I had a couple of comments and then a follow-up question from that. I'm Carly Shurtleff from the State Health Department in Utah. And we did a survey this year of the Meals on Wheels people in our state, throughout the state, and we don't have all the results in, but the preliminary results showed, we asked a Zoster question on it, it showed that over 80% of the respondents to the survey said that they were interested in getting a Zoster vaccine, which was really encouraging to us. Only about 7% of them had had one. The other comment I was going to make was related to the freezers. You were studying the GPs and the family practices, and there was a freezer problem. It surprises me that they wouldn't be having freezers in their offices for varicella. So I was just going to ask about that.
We found an association with not stocking and administering when you perceive that freezer storage is a major barrier, and that was not distinct. It was consistent with both family medicine physician perception and general internal medicine perception. So yes, family medicine doctors should be stocking varicella and presumably general internal medicine doctors too, but I think that it's not that common of a vaccine because most adults have had chickenpox in their childhood. So I think that's why we're finding that to be a major barrier for both specialties.
But in relation to the survey that I just was talking about with the high percentage of people that were interested in the vaccine, I was just also going to ask whether or not, because there seems to be high interest in the vaccine on the part of people, and there seems to be a lot of problem with the billing and the handling of the vaccine, do you think that the vaccine is not being recommended as often as it would be otherwise because of those issues rather than issues of efficacy?
I think you're right. I mean, I work in a system where we do not stock the vaccine, and I have to refer patients to the public health department, and for a lot of my patients, that's a barrier to going to get it. They'd rather just get it in my office. So I think the financial issues and the reimbursement issues are affecting physician recommendation of this vaccine.